Blog Talk Radio.
Conservative's perspective, and yes indeed, it has been a long time, and I'm glad to be back. I had to take some time off, as most of you know, and for those of you who came in late, my beloved mother passed last September, September 3rd, around 10:30 in the morning to be exact, and it was rather sudden, and not only was it a shock, it was a rather strong one. And in the aftermath of that, you know, there are a lot of things to be done. There are a lot of I's to dot and T's to cross, and you know, this case no exception. And I just decided to stop for a little while, and that's what I did. So I still kept the recorded program going after a week or two, but I just had to quit a little bit and take a little time to myself, and I'm back. I'm happy to be here. And would a triumphant return to observe the on Tuesday nights in particular without the one and only Mr. Michael Cutler with us again to see. You know, he's been a terrific friend to the program, but not only that, he's been a terrific friend to me as well. And what I would like to share with you guys before we go any further, and I know a lot of my Rutgers, you guys always get jacked up when you're going to be on the program. And I'm very happy about that because I do too. I get excited about it too. What I would tell you about Michael Cutler, the one thing is this. When you hear, and Mike and I have talked on the phone once, twice a month at least for the last 3 years or so, and the conversations we have on the phone are very, excluding the profanity and the off-color jokes from time to time, the conversations that we have here, the conversations that we have here on the phone or on the radio are very similar to what we do on the phone. And I'm happy that he's a guy. There's nothing dishonest about Michael Cutler. What you hear, what you see is what you get. Like Howard Cosell, he calls them like he sees them. And here he is, the one and only Michael Cutler. Mike, welcome back. It's good to have you with us. And it's great for you to be with me on my return at a semi-regular basis. It's good to have you here.
Huh. Thank you, James. And my condolences. And you know, I always tell people that the loss of a loved one, because people say dumb things because they don't know what else to say. Time heals and all this other business. It's an amputation, not the flu. And you know, life is difficult. By the way, you should know your microphone has been cutting in and out. I don't know if there's a loose wire someplace or whatever, James.
Okay, we'll try that and see if that
just
helps.
Just so you know. Yeah, but you know, one of my there's two favorite bumper stickers that I've seen over the years. One says, "The more people I meet, the more I love my dog," and I think you can understand that. But more
Absolutely.
Importantly, there was another bumper sticker that said, "Be kind to the people you meet. You don't know the battles they're fighting." And we're all wounded by life. My dad, I lost my parents to cancer within a year of each other when I was in college. So they've been gone for so many decades, and I still feel that I stand on their shoulders every day when I'm blessed to get out of bed because it was their guidance, their upbringing, as my mother would call it, the foundation that they gave me, because I was 21 when I was completely on my own, and they set the moral compass for me. And my dad used to say that everyone goes through hell in life, and he said, if you could hang your problems on a clothesline and then go up and down the block and look at your neighbor's clotheslines, bad as you think you might have it, you're going to probably come back for your own clothesline. And we need to be mindful. And I've seen so much greed and selfishness and self-centeredness, especially on the part of the politicians, but on other people who should be leaders. And I don't get it. You know, I'm in my mid-70s, and you wonder, where did the time go? And you hear the clock ticking louder every morning when you wake up, and you realize we're here for a visit. And there are people out there, the billionaires, who, if they could find someone to buy them, would pluck the eyeballs out of your head to sell them, even though they have 15 mansions, 5 airplanes that would qualify as airliners, and a yacht that would almost qualify as an ocean liner. But they still need more. They need more money and more power. And that's why politicians are a particular breed that we need to be mindful of, and why I support the Second Amendment, frankly. Because power for some people can become intoxicating. And I will tell you that I've had the privilege of working with many other law enforcement people from city, state, federal levels, and 99% are excellent human beings. They're role models. But there are a couple of knuckleheads who go crazy with the power the badge gives them. And I remember an old-time cop telling me, he said, "Mike, that badge doesn't give you as much power as it gives you accountability." And I've had encounters with cops where I did nothing wrong, but maybe I walked over to a police car and said, "You know, you triple parked, you're blocking traffic." And these young cops jumped out of the car. I didn't identify myself. I was an agent at the time. And they were ready to handcuff me, slug me. I don't know what they were ready to do. And I assure you I'm not. So it's not a race thing. There are certain people who should not be in whatever profession that is. And I don't care if it's law enforcement. I don't care if it's teaching. I don't care if it's medicine. They are round pegs and square holes, and society and the people in their profession all pay one hell of a price. And when we hear about police shootings, that any loss of life is a tragedy, period, full stop. As an agent, My job wasn't to inflict justice on the street. My job was to bring the individual in so that the justice system could run its course. Okay? That's a very important concept to remember. But there are some people who get the badge and think they've got it all. And, you know, I remember at the airport, we had people come in and they would say to me, do you know who I am? Because I started my career as an inspector. I guess somehow thinking that we would allow them to bring in that extra bottle of booze or God only knows what they were looking for. But when anyone would say to me, do you know who I am? I had a standard answer. Yes, if you're asking me that question, you're a jackass. Do you know who I am? Seriously. And unfortunately, we've become such a materialistic society. And I am a capitalist. Don't misunderstand me for a heartbeat. But we look at someone and say, oh, that guy had a successful life because he's worth $8 billion. Okay. How much money was Epstein worth when he croaked either by his own hand or someone else's hand or hands? God only knows. We may never know. Now, he had a lot of money. He had access to a lot of powerful people. He had his own island. Is he a success story? I don't think so. We need to recalibrate what constitutes success. My parents were very humble people. My mom came here ahead of the Holocaust as a 13-year-old, supported herself in a rooming house and lived in a rooming house and supported herself by working in a sweatshop making umbrellas for $3 a week. And by the time she was in her early 20s, she had gotten a job working as a buyer for a dress company. This was during the Depression. Her boss was so successful, he became one of Roosevelt's dollar-a-year men, going to the White House routinely to try to figure out how to jumpstart the economy. Very successful. And he could point to my mom as the reason he made so much money, because she was so bright and so sharp, and all she had was a fourth-grade education. What do we value? What do we value? My dad was a tradesman. And without tradesmen, we would have no society. Stop and think about it. The guys digging ditches, the electricians, the plumbers. My dad was a plumber, did construction. He worked on the World's Fair, worked on Kennedy Airport. Without those carpenters and bricklayers and you know, all those tradesmen, we'd be living in caves or under trees. We wouldn't have a society. There'd be no buildings. There'd be no roads. There'd be no cars. And yet somehow, as a society, we've come to look down our nose at people that, God forbid, get their hands dirty when they go to work. What do we value? Who do we value? And I look at these pretentious politicians, not all of them, but I'll never forget Barbara Boxer as a senator dressing down a general, I believe it was, because
yes,
she had the audacity to call her ma'am. Ma'am. Ma'am, I'm a senator. Wow. It blew me away. One of the things I like to do, and I do this with every politician I meet. I always refer to them by their first name. And there's a couple of politicians for whom I have tremendous respect. One of them was Louie Gohmert. Another one was Jeff Sessions. Jeff quoted me from the floor of the Senate during the contentious floor debates back around 2006 about comprehensive immigration reform. I'd written a piece for Front Page magazine. And I said, we need to give this piece of legislative detritus a new and more descriptive name. To get comprehensive immigration reform, we should be calling it the Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act. And Sessions liked what I wrote to the point that on three separate days, he quoted me with attribution from the floor of the U.S. Senate and then sent me a certificate commemorating it. And I heard about it. I didn't even know he was doing it when one of the 9/11 families called me up and said, the senator is standing on the floor quoting you, Mike. You need to get to your TV. You need to get to your computer. I said, well, I'm in my car. So Bruce, whose son-in-law was killed on 9/11, he was in the towers, immediately held his telephone next to his TV so I could hear Sessions. And it was a stunning moment for me with him and his people. I said, I'm so impressed that he did it with attribution. And they said to me, well, if he plagiarized you, number one, it would be unethical. And number two, he doesn't have your credibility on this issue. He was a very humble man. I was with Jeff Sessions in Florida because I write for the David Horowitz Freedom Center. And there were panel discussions, and he and I were on the same panel. I was greatly flattered, along with another congressman, Louie Gohmert, and another one, John Fleming. Well, John Fleming isn't in the House any longer, but Louie Gohmert is. And when I met Louie Gohmert, who's a real down-to-earth gentleman, he's from Texas, I said, you're going to have to forgive me, Congressman, but I have this nasty habit. When I speak with representatives, I refer to them by their first name because I like to establish the employer-employee relationship early on. And Louie laughed. And he said to me, Mr. Cutler, my mom and dad named me Louie. It's a wonderful name. And what else would you expect to call me unless it was foul language or whatever, made a joke? He said, you're right. We should be referred to by our first name. He said, when I was a judge, I insisted on being called judge, not because I was high and mighty, but because I was sitting in judgment of my neighbors and needed to erect a barrier so that I could be objective. But my title is representative. How in the world can I represent anybody if I put myself on a pedestal? I'll never forget those words. And I said, well, there's one mistake that we have to correct. He said, what's that? I said, you got to stop calling me Mr. Cutler. If you're Louie, then I'm Mike. And we shook hands. I think the world of the guy. But we have turned politicians into celebrities, and they're not. They're not. And I remember when my youngest son graduated from high school, there was an announcement at the proceedings that no politicians were going to be present to deliver a speech. And the audience gave that statement a standing ovation. Think about it.
Well, and
the job that
else we do, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was just thinking, it's something else that we do too. When you mentioned that we look at these politicians as great and wise leaders, we also look at celebrities, or we don't, you and I, but many people look at celebrities as deep things.
Oh, my goodness. You know, most actors and actresses, not all, there are exceptions. I had dinner with Robert Duvall, one of the most humble and decent people you could imagine, by the way. I had dinner with him twice. Real nice man. But so many of these people can't say three coherent words without a script writer.
Right.
And I remember an article about Johnny Carson, and they said that the strength that Johnny Carson had was that he could take actors and actresses who in real life were as boring as melting ice and turn them into likable characters by the way that he evoked responses from them, so the audience kind of got to relate to somebody who really was as boring as a rock. And they don't have all this wisdom, you know? We attribute all sorts of things. Think about celebrity endorsements. You know, if Mario Andretti, who is probably one of the most successful car racers in history, endorsed an automotive product, a shock absorber, a tire, engine. I'd probably consider buying it. I mean, he's Mario Andretti. He knows what he's talking about.
Exactly.
But how many people run out and buy an electric razor because an actor or an athlete are hawking that razor? What do they know about engineering or skin? If a dermatologist said, boy, this is a great razor, it's good for your skin, I'd listen. But some guy who's an actor and gets up in the morning and puts on a costume and play pretends of being somebody he could never be or she could never be, oh, I'm going to buy that because so-and-so was advertising it. Why do we pay that kind of money for people who have no background in the issue tell us that that's the product to buy? How foolish are we? How foolish? And how foolish are we when we listen to politicians and don't question what they're telling us? You know, one of the things that's really interesting, and I hope things go well tonight. I went out to vote with my wife today, and I walked into the school where the election was being conducted, and I said, well, this is trash day. We get to throw out the trash, hopefully. And she laughed, and I laughed. We used to have voting machines with little levers on them. Well, the little lever reminded me of something else. I used to say that it was the day that we flushed the toilet, okay? So,
yeah.
I mean, really and truly, as a federal agent, I wasn't allowed to take a cup of coffee on duty. And these people are taking with both hands, and you don't think they're influenced? And then some of these guys have the chutzpah, as we say in Brooklyn. I mean, what else would you expect from a Jewish kid from Brooklyn but to use the word chutzpah? You know, the example of chutzpah that was classic is the kid that kills both parents and then pleads for mercy because he's an orphan. Now, that's chutzpah, right? And so you have these politicians out there who have even more chutzpah than that. And they lie through their teeth, And some of them will say to you, I don't take PAC money. There was a politician in Florida, a congressman, who did a little mini documentary. He's a Republican. The other guy with him was a Democrat. We've taken the vow of no PAC money. And I thought, what a charlatan. Because if they get money from the party, and I promise you they all do, if they get money from the Democrat or Republican parties, guess what? Where the money is coming from? From the PACs. So to stand there, look at me, and pound his chest and congratulate, I don't take PAC money. And you know, no one ever said, well, wait a minute, what about the money that the party gives you? Where's that money coming from? The way that politics works is the party runs the member of Congress. Think about the position known as the whip. The whip. The whip sounds like a Tony Soprano enforcer, doesn't it? The whip. Got to keep those bums in line. Well, let me read a quote to you, and then I'm going to tell you who said it. If you folks are familiar with history, you'll recognize it. If not, it may be an eye-opener, and I hope it's thought-provoking. However, political parties may now and then answer popular ends. They are likely, in the course of time and things, to become potent engines by which cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men will be enabled to subvert the power of the people and to usurp for themselves the reins of government, destroying afterwards the very engines which have lifted them to unjust dominion. That's a pretty strong statement. That's one hell of a condemnation of the political parties, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
The speaker was George Washington on the occasion of his farewell address. So I'm raising this issue because you need to realize, and I hope that we get rid of a lot of garbage. I really do. But you need to realize that The Hill just published an article, and this was 11/5, so 3 days ago. And the title was, Here Are the 10 Biggest Donors in the Midterm Elections. And, of course, George Soros came in at number one, and he, of course, supports the lunatic left. By the way, why in the world do we call the lunatic left liberals? I have a confession. I'm a liberal. I have a bigger confession. I raise my children to be liberals. And before you guys get all excited, if you look up liberal, it's really a person who understands the concept that everyone, and I mean everyone in this country, has the entitlement, the guaranteed entitlement under the First Amendment, to have their own thoughts, their own ideas, and should have the ability to articulate their ideas without fear. Unless they're calling for, you know, murder, or they're yelling fire in a crowded theater, you know, the usual exceptions to free speech. But if you stay within the guardrails, everybody has an absolute positive right to say what's on their mind without fear, period, full stop. And I don't care if it's about abortion or school pair or the Second Amendment. I don't care. That's your right. That's what the Constitution is about. We're about to celebrate Veterans Day. That's what the soldiers have fought for since the founding of this nation. Your freedom to speak your mind, period. There's a wonderful song that Sinatra sings. Others have sung it. I love his rendition, The House I Live In. The subtitle is, What is America to Me? And one of the lines in the song is, the right to speak your mind out. That's America to me. The right to speak your mind out? The cancel culture and the radical lunatics? And we still call them liberals? And some foolish people call them libertards, like they're insulting them. They're not liberals. They are totalitarians. They are fascists. Yeah. They are authoritarians. Give them the power, and they will dictate everything for you, down to the color of your underwear of the day. And Mr. Obama stands there saying that democracy is at stake. Well, he's right. Because if we continue down that path of cancel, they will cancel our rights under the Constitution, because they've already done a good job of whittling away at them. You see? So when you say someone's a liberal and you're talking about a radical lunatic on the left, you're attributing a trait that they're not entitled to. And that helps them gain power, because a lot of people aren't paying attention. And they say, well, I'm a liberal. They're liberals. I guess they represent me. No, they don't represent you. And no, they're not liberals.
Oh, no.
They're the antithesis of liberal. Am I getting anything wrong here, James?
No, no, exactly. The liberal, how can I say this? The liberal that you're talking about, that you yourself are, and I know this to be true, is liberal in the classical sense. And what these people
right.
have done, these cultural Marxists, these people that you and I, you know, and there are, I'm going to tell you something, people, there's no more purpose than me and Mike Cutler. City, country, Democrat, Republican, Jew, but all those things, none of that matters because we see the extremists there on the left. We also see the extremists on the right as well.
Yep.
And we've got our about 10%, well, 20%. You got 10% on the right, 10% on the left on average, trying to tell 80% of the rest of us we need to be doing. And that's not liberalism. Liberalism in its classical sense would be Thomas Jefferson. It would be John Adams. It would be Benjamin Franklin. It would be Michael Cutler. I'm going to go ahead and lump him in with the legends as well. But it's a tolerant, broad-minded viewpoint. It's not radical, and it never has been radical. And it doesn't necessarily accept radical ideas.
Right.
And I don't understand how people could think. But you're right. People look at it and say liberal, and they equate that with this reasonable and moderate definition that you understand it to be, and that is not what these people are at all. They are wolves in sheep's clothing, and they will do anything. They will take any position. They will say anything to any particular group at any given time to cement their power base and to broaden it.
And that's the game that's played by the politicians. Now, you know, I compare politicians to magicians. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, we've all seen that. I probably have said this on your program before, but perhaps on election eve, it's worth repeating. Because let me tell you, getting your candidate elected, hopefully today, whoever you voted for, I hope you get the candidate you voted for, and I hope it's a good candidate. But, you know, as Orrin Hatch, the late Orrin Hatch said, and I had dealings with his office, and he was very helpful. In fact, in even getting the 9/11 commission assembled and so forth. But Orrin Hatch said, as he retired from the Senate shortly before his death, that it's impossible for an honest person to go to Washington and stay honest. Think about that. And so the quandary for the politician is they need the money in order to run a campaign to win the election. So the Hill had the 10 biggest donors, and all the conservatives will come up to me and they'll say, Mike, George Soros. And I'll say, well, he's not the only one. You've got the Koch brothers. Now it's the Koch brother. You have all these others. Well, what's interesting, if you look at the Hill article, 9 out of 10 are on the Republican side. And many of those big donors are into globalist perspectives and goals. I remember testifying at a hearing, and some guy affiliated with the Chamber of Commerce, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, during a recess, because the members of Congress had to go vote, came up to me. You know, we were both witnesses at this hearing. There were four witnesses. It was before the House Judiciary Committee, and I've done a bunch of those hearings. And he came up to me during the recess, shook hands. Mike, my name is, you know, whoever, and we started to chat. And he said, but you've got to do me a favor here. He says, really and truly, you've got to stop this nonsense about border security. Now, this is about 15 years ago. And I was kind of taken aback. And I said, do you realize that that border, and it's not just the Mexican border, and we need to talk about that this evening also, obviously. He said to me, that border is an impediment to my wealth and the wealth of my colleagues. I said, that border is our first and last line of defense. And he said, get over it. It's inevitable that people will die. The enormity of what he said to me in that setting, standing in this majestic room that is the hearing room for the House Judiciary Committee. It's the size of a gymnasium. If any of you have seen it on TV, when you go there, it's even more impressive when you're standing in the middle of the room. The ceiling, I think, extends about 5 stories above you. It's an incredible room. It's just like a house of worship. The congressional buildings were designed to be imposing and provide a sense of awe to all who enter. This is the seat of government for the United States of America, and it needs to look that way, you see. So here we are in the middle of this incredible room that has been the scene of so many hearings, many of which I've testified at, by the way. I think I've done 17 hearings in the House and Senate. I was told it's a record for a non-official. I do it mostly as a civilian, right? And it enraged me. And I said, what do you mean people are going to die? It's inevitable. And he said, you can't make the world safe, but meanwhile, you're costing us money. My rage was beyond belief. I mean, how would you feel?
I'm sitting here listening to you say that, and I'm stunned in a way. Yep. Not surprised, but for the most part, I'm stunned at the level of callousness that goes with
saying something like that. And I looked at him and I said, I have a prayer for you. He said, what's your prayer, Mr. Cutler? I said, well, I'm not particularly religious, but I do have a prayer for you. And I pray that if, God forbid, America gets attacked, that they don't hurt a hair on your head. And he said to me, you're very kind and compassionate. I said, the hell I am. I want you to live through the attack, but I want you to be inches away from your family when they get vaporized. I want you to smell the burning flesh. And you had to see the look on his face. And he said to me, would you like to step outside? I said, more than I would like to breathe. And I started taking my jacket off. He threw himself in his chair and buried himself in his papers. And that was the last foolish thing that came out of his head. It was a wow moment. It was a wow moment. So in other words, there's an acceptable level of fatality if he can make money. You know, I really have to wonder, with all the people that pay politicians, how much money perhaps is being paid to the Biden administration and people on the other side as well. I'm an equal opportunity insulter. How much money is the funeral industry paying these politicians to get all these Americans killed, whether it's through fentanyl poisoning, through gang crimes, or, God forbid, the next terror attack? Just let that thought sink in. And I'd like to know, and let's get to the border now. Why do we hear so much about the southern border and nothing about the other borders or the other means by which aliens can enter the United States, or drugs or other contraband or weapons can be smuggled into the United States? I watch Fox News all the time. I haven't been on with them in quite some time. By the way, Newsmax has been having me on quite frequently, and there is no censorship. When I come on to Newsmax, they just tell me, let her rip. To their credit. To their credit. And I write for Front Page Magazine. I hope after the program everybody will check out my articles. But one of my more recent articles, let me pull this up. The title
from October 14th,
was The Crisis on the Southern Border, only the tip of Biden's immigration iceberg.
I've been looking through that right now. And it's solid. I was reading through here. I'm sorry. I just wanted to say this. And this is a point you've made over and over and over again. And I don't understand why people – well, I think I can understand why the media passes it by. In your article – there are over 100 international airports located all over the country. Smugglers are using them all over. They use them every day. And nobody ever stops
and
to think about all these
landing strips.
These unauthorized, any port entry that these people can penetrate, they do every day.
And we have 95,000 miles of coastline. And it's not just coming into the port of entry. Look, the Golden Venture, for those of you that don't remember, I'll remind you, because we had an emergency. The Golden Venture was a ship that came from China that washed ashore in the Rockaways here in New York. And it was a real scow. The ship was falling apart. The conditions were deplorable beyond words. There were vermin on the ship and very sick people. And it went aground, and the Coast Guard went out there, and we took over 100 people off the ship. And they were trying to get in by not going through a port of entry, but by coming to shore apart from a port of entry, just like the Mexican border. So I want everyone to understand this. The Mexican border is roughly 2,000 miles. And let me be clear so nobody misunderstands for a heartbeat what I'm saying. Is the Mexican border dangerous and significant? It's dangerous beyond all comprehension. Hezbollah, and I've been writing about this. It's been part of open hearings, and I don't know why people on TV don't use this material that's available in open hearings. The hearings are held so the American people could watch and listen. And I've yet to see anybody, even former officials under Trump, talk about the hearings. Because one of the points made at one of the hearings is that Hezbollah has been working throughout Latin America with human traffickers and drug smugglers, often one and the same, to push huge numbers of people and narcotics into the United States. Number one, to fund Iran's terror operations around the world. But number two, to kill Americans with the drugs. And number three, to enable sleeper agents to enter the United States to carry out attacks when they're called upon. So that's how dangerous the Mexican border is. So I don't want anyone to walk away from the show and say, what the hell's wrong with Cutler? He said that the Mexican border is not a big deal. It's a huge deal. But it's not the only deal, and that's the problem. And we all get caught up in box scores. Everybody wants a statistic. I used to do podcasts to someone. I won't mention his name, but we actually had an argument on air. Some people can be silly, pigheaded. I don't know. And I don't have all the answers. By the way, my parents warned me that if you meet someone who claims to have all the answers, run for your life. But I do think I have at least a little background in the immigration issue. Okay? And everyone gets excited. How many people were deported under Trump? How many people were deported under Biden? Those numbers are meaningless. They're meaningless. Let me give you an example. And I've asked this question when I do speaking events. If, let's say, a Border Patrol sector along the Mexican border, or the Canadian border for that matter, reported zero arrests for an entire month. The entire sector had zero arrests. Tell me, is that good news or bad news? What do you
think?
Don't
really
know.
Well,
that's right.
It could be good news. You don't know.
Right. If we've been so good at
enforcing
the laws.
Because these guys are doing their job?
Right. Yeah. Or were they at the bar getting drunk because they've been bought off? Either way, you get zero arrests.
Exactly.
So let me give you maybe a better example to think about. How many people have been arrested trying to break into Fort Knox? There's certainly a goal to be gotten there other than Goldfinger. I don't know of anybody who tried to break into Fort Knox with all that gold that's there.
Not since him.
The security force at Fort Knox have made zero arrests. Does that mean that they're not doing their job, or does it mean that they're doing their job so well that no one even thinks to try? So when everyone jumps up and down about arrest statistics, you can't look at the numbers the way you do a box score at the end of a ball game. Well, the Yankees scored 5 runs, and, no, it's not what it is. It's how you interpret the numbers. And then what happened to the aliens after they were arrested, you see? And then what George W. Bush did, because he was a con artist of amazing proportions, he was worried about high school dropout rates when he was governor. So he turned around and said, under state law, when someone is over the age of 16, they're not required to go to high school anymore. So if a 16 or a 17-year-old drops out of high school, we're not going to count them because by law, they don't have to be in school anyway. So suddenly, this is what I was told, that he did this, if that's in fact the case. So suddenly, the dropout rate plummeted by, double digits. Because up until then, apparently, everyone was counted. If you didn't graduate, you were counted as a dropout. But by saying, well, they're not required to go to school once they hit their 16th birthday, so let's not count them. So how many people were removed from the statistics for dropouts? Never forget that figures don't lie, but liars can figure, okay? So one of the things that George W. did was to change the language. So instead of using the word deportation, they used the word removal. Now, a deportation meant somebody who was in the country, found to be in violation of law, either they ran the border or they committed fraud to get a visa, so they're here, or maybe they had a green card, but then they were arrested and convicted of committing felonies. So that makes them deportable also. So deportable means they are physically in the country, and a judge has to order them deported so that if they come back again, they're looking at a felony for being here after being formally deported from the United States. Now, at the airport, if someone gets turned around or excluded from the United States, that was a separate number, and it had very different implications. Now, the advantage I have, I was an agent for 26 years, but I was also an inspector for the first 4 years of my career. And then during that four-year time, I was assigned for a full year doing the marriage interviews as an adjudicator. So I really took the scenic tour. So at the airport, if someone comes into your booth and you say to the guy, well, how long do you plan to stay? And the guy says, I'm going to be here for 3 weeks. Do you have a return ticket? And he has a one-year open, which is the most expensive way to get a ticket. You become suspicious. And then you would say, well, how much money do you have? Let's say the guy was from Ecuador or Guatemala. Just pick a country. And he had the hands of a farmer. And I will tell you that farmers' hands in Latin America, their hands are disfigured. They look like lobster claws. The suffering of these farm workers is incalculable and unimaginable. I look at immigration very differently from most people because I did the job and saw things up close and in person on a day-to-day basis for 26 years. And then the time I was at the airport gave me more insight. So picture some guy who has calloused feet. He's wearing shoes for the first time. He can barely walk in them. He's wearing the first suit he ever put on, and many of them would forget to take the labels off because they had no idea that you remove the labels that are sewn onto the sleeve and so forth. It could almost be funny, but it was tragic. And their hands were so calloused and swollen that they looked like catcher's mitts. I mean, how do you live with hands that look like catcher's mitts? Just imagine that. And you'd say to the guy, how much money do you have? And he'd say, I have $800. This was back in the 70s. And I said, show me your money. So he would take out a wad of bills with a 100 bill usually on top with rubber bands. And it was so filthy that the rubber bands had been eating their way into this wad of money that was the size of a baseball. Because that money is being passed from one to another to another to another. If we had computers then and you were able to register the serial numbers, you would probably see this money showing up 10 times a year, coming in at different ports with different people because they would hand it back to the person that facilitated their visa to come to the United States, you see? So we would turn them around. And turning them around is not the same as the deportation because he had $800 in his left pocket, all rubber banded together, and then you would search him, which we have the right to do at a port of entry. And we would find that he had $3.12 in his other pocket. That was really his money. So you know the guy does not have the wherewithal to remain in the United States without either becoming a public charge or taking illegal employment, which is a big deal back in the 70s when I was an inspector to protect the jobs of Americans. And when people start this nonsense, you're anti-immigrant, oh, you're a xenophobe, no, you're a racist, okay. I want everybody after the program, and if you go to my articles, I frequently include the link to Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182. I'll repeat it. Grab your pencil. Well, you can listen to this recording when the podcast is up. It's Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182. It lists the categories of aliens who are to be excluded from the United States. They're deemed inadmissible. Not a single word concerns race, religion, ethnicity. If it did, I couldn't have enforced those laws for 30 seconds, let alone 30 years. It starts out with aliens who have dangerous communicable diseases. Ellis Island was a quarantine station. And think about COVID today. Aliens who are severely mentally ill. Aliens who are criminals, terrorists, spies, human rights violators, drug smugglers, human traffickers, fugitives from justice, aliens who have been previously deported, and aliens who either would become a public charge or, if they work, would displace American workers and cost Americans their jobs, or at the very least, suppress the wages being paid to American workers. And I'd love to know who could argue against the enforcement of laws that are focused, to sum it up, on protecting national security, public safety, public health, and the jobs and wages of Americans. And I'd love to know why the people who worked for Trump never concisely made the point, because this is irrefutable. Those laws guided every decision we made at a port of entry and made it easy for us to figure out what to target when we were enforcing the laws from within the interior. Who could be opposed to protecting public safety, national security, public health, or the jobs of Americans? If you had to sum it up, That's the purpose of the immigration laws. Period, full stop. So when you have the Democrats, oh, we want to help you. We want to build, we're going to build jobs. Really? Then why are you importing an army of foreign workers, more workers than the number of new jobs that we create every year? How does that help the average American worker? If you haven't noticed, the middle class is on the endangered species list. I think next week they may put the middle class on exhibit at the Museum of Natural History next to the mastodons.
You know what? You remind me, because that's exactly, I knew where you were going with this based on our conversation from this weekend, but it does. What, this influx of people, and again, as to the southern border, this issue is a hydra. They're, you know, they're heads all over the place, and every time you cut one off, they find another way to, you know, to circumvent what's going on. And it is, you're right, it put the squeeze on the middle class and to make it even smaller and ultimately just choke it off.
Yes, and if you read what Alan Greenspan had to say about middle class, about high-tech workers, he said the solution to wage inequality is to make high-tech American workers. Workers who have advanced degrees, MBAs, PhDs, make them compete with foreign workers. Why? Because then you could get rid of that wage premium because they're making more money than they should be making. He actually said that at a hearing on April 30th, 2009. I watched the damn hearing live streaming on my computer. And he said that if you made the American worker compete with foreign workers through the wage pricing mechanism of foreign competition, we could cut that premium that they're being paid. And that way you would greatly reduce inequality in wages between Americans with skills and those with lesser skills. In other words, the guy with the MBA should not be making much more than the guy who dropped out of high school. It's called communism. He actually had the chutzpah, there's that word again, to refer to middle-class workers, high-tech middle-class workers. You ready for this, folks? The privileged elite. This is the guy that has a mansion in the Hamptons and God knows
Holy
how many
Hannah.
Other mansions scattered around the world, right? But he has the brass balls to refer to middle-class high-tech workers as the privileged elite. I'm old enough to remember when Sputnik was launched. I was always a science guy. I was bitten by the astronomy bug when I was in third grade. One of my close friends had a brother who went on to get a PhD in astrophysics. And one day he sat down with me. He wasn't at that point, you know, he was only a few years older, but he had already been bitten by the science bug also. And so he started talking to me about astronomy. And I was smitten. That was it. I still love astronomy. And growing up, my heroes weren't ball players or whatever. My heroes growing up were people like Chuck Yeager, Alan Shepard, and Gus Grissom. As a kid, I got letters from Shepard and Grissom. I wouldn't trade those letters for any sports memorabilia in the world. When I had cancer 20-odd years ago, my wife, to cheer me up, got me a model of the X-1 autographed by Chuck Yeager, the first man to break the sound barrier. And then I liked that airplane so much that I went out and bought a model of the P-51 Mustang that he used to become an ace during the Second World War that he also autographed. And then she got me a Peter Max poster that was being sold on one of the TV shopping networks autographed by Buzz Aldrin. That hangs in my living room. I met Gene Kranz. I met Jim Lovell, Dave Scott, Jim McDivitt. I have a photo, as I said, with Gene Kranz. And when I gave a speech a couple of years ago in Washington to a room filled with Air Force brass, I was stunned to find out that one of the people in my audience in Washington had just come back from the space station. So we took photos together, and it was an amazing experience to find out that one of the people listening to my presentation was a guy whose background didn't look real, because I looked up his bio, and I felt like not only I was an underachiever, I felt like a non-achiever. The guy got his degree in engineering at the Air Force Academy, got his master's degree in engineering at MIT, and then was part of the team to certify the F-22 Raptor for combat. And then there was a whole resume of all the aircraft that he had testified and certified for combat. And it was like, you know, the Jane's weapons encyclopedia.
Wow.
And he was, forgive the pun, But I've noticed this about all the astronauts I've met, whether it was Jim Lovell, Dave Scott, who walked on the moon. Jim McDivitt, by the way, was with Ed White when he did that first spacewalk. So when you see those videos of Ed
right.
White with that little gun in his hand, the reaction control gun that he used to pull himself out of the Gemini capsule, well, Jim McDivitt was his lifelong friend. They grew up together, and he was the one who filmed Ed White on that spacewalk because he was the other pilot on that Gemini spacecraft. And every one of them had a common trait. They were all astronauts, but are you ready for this one? They were all very much down to earth. When I met Jim McDivitt, it was a week after the Apollo 11 astronauts had gone through the booth behind mine at the International Arrival Building, and I was so upset that, boy, oh, boy, I almost got to meet the Apollo 11 astronauts. I got to see their backs as they walked out of the Arrivals Hall. A week later, I'm sitting in my booth, and who walks in but Jim McDivitt? And McDivitt had flown to the moon, and I mean, his another amazing career. And I was taking flying lessons back then. And so I said to him, I said, you know, this is going to sound kind of silly. I mean, I'm a huge fan. I said, I'm actually taking flying lessons, but my God, to actually meet you, it makes my week. It makes my month. And he looked at me and he said, I got a question for you. I said, okay. He said, have you soloed yet? I said, yeah, I did. Why? He said, well, now you have the right to call yourself an aviator. He said, anybody who flies in space even once has the right to refer to himself as an astronaut. If you took an airplane off the ground without the instructor and brought it back in one piece, he said to me, Mr. Cutler, you are now an aviator. I hope you realize that. And it stunned me. There was no ego. By the way, I do an internet radio program Friday nights, the Michael Cutler Hour on Blog Talk. The guy who started that is a guy by the name of Tom Garcia. Tom Garcia is an American Airlines pilot. It was his idea to do radio, and he, you know, hooked up with me, and we did some shows together, and he arranged for me to have that program initially, and then I took it over. Tom Garcia was a Top Gun instructor. We can sit down, and he'll answer all the questions I have. He has the patience of a saint, and he made the same point. He said to me, you and I are colleagues in aviation. I said, are you kidding? I never even got my license. And he said, Mike, how many people can lay claim to having soloed an airplane? He said, do you ever fly solo? I said, yeah, I got about 20 hours of solo time. I said, one day I actually got up to 10,000 feet, and it's going to sound silly to you, but I felt like an astronaut. And he laughed, and I laughed, and he said, don't make light of it. He said, flying is flying. And that's what struck me. I look at the egos of these football players, the baseball players, and all this, all the hoopla. These are guys who went to the moon. These are guys who have flown airplanes that are unbelievable. And yet they look at me and they didn't say, what, are you kidding me? You flew this little thing with a propeller? No, you're an aviator, Mr. Cutler. The humility, the sense of humanity that was so strong in each and every astronaut that I've had the privilege of meeting blew me away. Going back to what do we value as a society and who do we value as a society? Think about that. And I'm so sick and tired of what has been happening to America. Because when Sputnik was launched, I will never forget it. It was a Friday. I had a miserable cold. I was kept home from school. I remember watching The Life of Riley on my parents' 13-inch black and white Dumont television. Those of you who are relics like me will remember
Dumont.
Those days.
Oh, man. With the Dumont television.
Okay.
Know that.
Okay. And
wow.
It had a wooden
cabinet.
It's funny. It finally breathed its last. I was watching a war movie with my dad, and, you know, the battleships were blazing away with their cannon, and smoke started pouring out of the TV. Something shorted. And I remember, I haven't thought about this in years. You're getting me to laugh tonight, which is a good thing. And I turned to my father and I said, my God, Dad, we've just suffered a direct hit. But I remember, you know, those amazing days. And so I was watching The Life of Riley and they broke in with a bulletin saying that Russia had just launched the world's first artificial satellite. And then they said, this is what space sounds like. And then you heard the beeping of the transmitter that was in the Sputnik satellite. And I got all excited. My father said, what are you so happy about? I said, look what they did. He said, Mike, they're our enemy. And I had no concept about enemies or allies or any of that. I mean, I was 10 years old. I was in fifth grade. But I was so into science. And I remember that Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, arguably one of the best presidents we've had, and his background, incredible. Not hardly a community organizer. He was Supreme Commander of Allied Forces, right? And he said, we have to respond to the Russians. And we're going to teach American kids math and science so that they are the best and brightest in the world so that America and its future will continue to lead. And I came to school on Monday or Tuesday, and my teachers called me in, and they said, look, we've been given an order from Board of Education headquarters to start teaching science. We don't have science teachers. So would you be willing to stand in front of the classroom on Thursdays for an hour and talk about anything you want about science? Just tell us in advance what you're going to discuss. So my dad and I went to a greengrocer. We bought a couple of orange crates. He hammered them together for me. I painted them, and I hung up a sign, and I could still see that sign in my mind's eye, Science Corner. And they jammed two or three classrooms of kids into the classroom, and I explained how a satellite stayed in orbit. I explained how airplanes flew and other such things. And after about 3 months, the Board of Education rushed some licensed science teachers into the school to meet the demand created by the White House to make sure that American kids got a first-rate education. And now we hear from the likes of Ted Cruz and all these others on both sides. For America to lead, we need to bring in the world's best and brightest. And, you know, I remember a gal calling me up. I forget if she was in the Carolinas or Georgia. It doesn't much matter. And Ted Cruz was out there making the speech. And the audience was going nuts. I could hear it in the background because she was on her phone with me. And what was Cruz saying? We're going to bring the world's best and brightest so America can lead. And I said, what are they cheering about? This is like a bunch of barnyard chickens getting all excited because Colonel Sanders just announced a new recipe. Why do we want to import an army? How's that for an analogy?
Pretty good. But you're right. We cheer. They cheer the knife that's getting ready to cut their...
Right. Dumb is this. Instead of saying, we better make sure. Now, we're hearing about how the scores are falling because of the COVID lockdown. And I don't doubt that the COVID lockdown has been very, very harmful. Let's be clear about that. But here's something that no one's asking. Could it also be that the numbers for literacy and math ability and so forth are plummeting because we have flooded American schools with kids from all over the world who do not read, write, or speak English? Is it possible that the scores are plummeting because more and more resources are going to kids to teach them English as a second language than to take care of American children with learning disabilities? My youngest son, that I've spoken about him frequently, has autism, something that's called Asperger's, although now they say that they don't want to make differentiation. It's all autism, which is nuts, but okay, so be it. But because of early intervention and incredible therapists and teachers, my son wound up with a full scholarship, has a degree in engineering, graduated with honors, and is working in his profession and just got a promotion at age 25. And he's doing beyond anything any of us could have imagined 10 years ago. Why are we not doing as much as we can? And by the way, we had to fight the Board of Education to get the funding so he could go to the school that he desperately needed to get into, where he could get the services that he needs. And I said to these people in the Board of Ed at the time, without getting too much afield into this area, but they were dead set against it. And I said, well, you better face reality. You're either going to have to spend some now or lots more later. If by luck, with a little bit of help from God or whatever, divine intervention, he succeeds, instead of being a burden, he could become a contributor. And think of the quality of life he will have. But if he doesn't get the services, his future is bleak, and he will forever be a burden. Why don't you see this as an investment? Well, eventually they did, and it worked out just that way. I can't even tell you. I get choked up thinking about his successes. But the point of the matter is, why are we so fascinated and fixated on helping illegal aliens, people who have no inherent right to be here, while we ignore the plight of American children? The radical left says, well, we need to get rid of the jails. Well, I have a good idea and a good first step about that, because first of all, I don't think prisons really are correctional facilities. They use that term euphemistically and optimistically, but most people go in and come out worse if they do come out, if they're not there for life. Very few are in for life now. And we don't seem to have an understanding. And I agree with no bail for a guy that's speeding and doesn't have $300 to post bond and he winds up in jail. Yeah, that kind of is an economic punishment when you think about it, unless he hasn't done other things that endanger lives. That's how it was sold to us. And, of course, once they got the foot in the door, then they jammed it wide open. And suddenly a guy that does an armed robbery but doesn't shoot anyone is declared to have not committed a violent crime. I've never had someone shove a gun in my face, but I had a couple of friends who experienced that. They were never the same. How could you be the same after some lunatics thrust a gun in your face and threatens to blow your brains out? It's a violent crime. The threat by itself is damaging enough, traumatic enough. But how did that kid that's doing that robbery wind up in that situation in the first place? Why aren't we addressing the conditions under which these children live, the dysfunctional homes? And now, what are they doing, the radical lunatics? Parents who are concerned about their children and their education. I was the president of my daughter's PTA, you know, the PTA, the Parents Association, having a Biden moment, forgive me. We wanted to encourage parents to be involved with their kids, to help them with their homework, to do projects together, to strengthen the bond between parent and child. When my first wife died, I was a single parent. And my son was all that I had. And, you know, he also graduated with honors. He's another engineer. Because I understood that the most important job I have is to be a father. If I fail as a parent, then whatever I do as an agent or do anywhere else to me would be meaningless. Priorities. So instead of encouraging parents to be involved with their kids, right, what are they doing? You're coming to the Parent Association meeting. You're going to the school board and telling them what to teach your kids. You're a domestic terrorist. We're going to stick the FBI on you. Instead of saying we're happy that you're involved, American parents are being told, don't be involved. Give us your children so we can raise them for you. Twist them for you. Pervert them for you, perhaps. Am I getting anything wrong here, James?
No, you're not missing it. You're not missing it at all. And it's horrifying. As most of you guys know, I'm in the school business myself. And I'm very proud of the fact that where I live, the County Board of Education is solid. They're genuinely concerned about what is in the best interest of the students. And the special ed department for the county is one of the best in the state. I'm convinced of that because I see the people who work in it. But overall, Michael, yeah, it's horrifying, and it goes beyond the primary school system, but into the college and university system. It's awful. It's a cancer. For the last 25 years, yep. And you know this to be true. Folks have been taught what to think rather than how to think, and you've got a bunch of these indoctrinated zombies.
Yep.
That are running around today spewing all this stuff.
And you know what Einstein said? He said facts aren't nearly as important as concepts. So why are concepts important? Because once you master concepts, it brings us back to the ability to reason and ask the right questions to get the right answers. You know, Voltaire observed that you judge a person's intelligence by the questions they ask. So we're given this garbage about follow the science. So understand, science isn't a book. It's not a bookshelf in the library. And you say, oh, there's a science book. All my answers are there. No, they aren't there. Science is really a way of organizing thoughts and asking the appropriate questions. I was on the phone. I've become friends with a gentleman who had a major role in the nuclear Navy. I've been so blessed because of the work I've been doing to become friends and acquaintances and meet with some truly incredible human beings. General Paul Vallely, who used to be senior military advisor to Fox News, retired two-star general. He and I have become good friends. I've been to his home in Montana. He arranged a speaking event for me out there. And so you meet all these amazing people with incredible achievements. Again, I sometimes look at what they've done with their lives and what I've done with my life, and I think, gee whiz, I've been asleep at the switch, you know? Amazing. But I remember speaking with this one gentleman who had worked in the nuclear program in the Navy, and he's done other work within the area of nuclear energy. And I said, do you know what the biggest return that we've gotten from the space program? And he said to me, Mike, are you kidding? You want me to distill it down to one? He said, we could talk about the benefits of the space program for the next week. I said, that might be true, but I think there's one thing in particular that we got out of this that really sums it all up. He said, okay, this one I want to hear. And I said, what we've gotten from the space program is the next set of questions. And he was in total agreement. When I mentioned before I had cancer, the first thing my surgeon told me, and this guy was amazing. He was the chairman of the department at the hospital where I was to be treated. He's one of the scientists who not only treats cancer, but devised the PSA test. I mean, this guy's a world-class scientist, doctor, surgeon, right? And his area is urology. Couldn't be better in terms of qualifications, okay? And the first thing he said to me is get a second opinion so that you know you're making the right decision. And if you still have questions, get a third opinion. This is New York. There's no shortage of hospitals or doctors. But I don't want you saying that you want me to take care of you until you've gotten at least one second opinion. What happened to follow the science? He obviously cured me, which is good because I haven't aggravated my quota yet. But what happened to follow the science? There's different opinions. You can go into a courtroom and see expert witnesses take either side of a complex argument or a complex case involving science. And the more we know, the more that we find out that we don't know. The Big Bang Theory is only a theory. It's not the Big Bang fact. For years, we were told eggs were harmful. Now we're told eggs are okay. What happened? So we're being told, follow the science. God forbid you question anything. And that goes for climate change as well, by the way. It goes for everything. So instead of teaching American kids science so they understand scientific principles, which to me is vital. And, you know, I had the privilege of admitting Carl Sagan back when I was an inspector. Of course, he was world famous astrophysicist. He was behind the Voyager program that sent space probes out of the solar system. Amazing guy. And so if you're going to follow the science, well, goodness, teach science. Carl Sagan recommended that everyone should learn astronomy. As he put it, the study of astronomy is character building. Think about that. For everybody with enlarged ego-itis, realize that as human beings, we basically inhabit a mote of dust suspended in the infinity of space. And our life expectancy is not even the blink of an eye on the cosmic scale. So now where's your big ego? When the first astronauts get to Mars and they look for the Earth, it'll only appear to be a star in the sky. I don't know how you cope with that kind of isolation. It'll take special people to do that. But somehow we always find people that rise up to the challenge. But these people that have these huge egos, do you know who I am? Seriously? It's lacking, and it's not being taught in the schools, and morality and decency and fairness, not being taught in schools. But we're being taught to question our sexuality. Really? We're being taught what a terrible country America is. So here's my problem. If you think America is that terrible and you look at America's enemies, would anybody who would like to destroy America like to go live in one of the countries that are our adversaries, perhaps China? Look at what China has done with the Uyghurs, the Muslims who live within their borders. Look how they treat their own people. Look at North Korea. Look at Iran.
Yeah.
Look at how Iran deals with the gay community or non-Muslims, or if you're on the wrong side of the Muslim faith. So if you think America is bad, but America is all that's there to shield you from China, Iran, Russia, Korea, are you crazy? This is kind of like Wile E. Coyote winding up, running off the cliff, and then he looks down but doesn't plummet until he sees the impossibility of his predicament. My mother used to say, you don't throw out the dirty water until you have clean water. Can America be made better? Absolutely. That's what the founding fathers said right off the bat, in order to make a more perfect union. And we're working at it. And we've made bad decisions in the past, and we've corrected them because we're human, and humans make terrible decisions. And I could be on your program for the next year, an hour or 2 hours every week, and I could discuss all of my bad decisions over the next 2 years and not run out of topics, because we're human. We're not flawless. We're not perfect. We make dumbass mistakes. But my gosh, I will put America up against any other country on this planet. What do you think of that, James?
Well, I'm in agreement, and if we are the last best hope of freedom, if we lose it here, where do we go? Where do we go?
And I didn't always agree with Ronald Reagan, but he said something that was brilliant. He said, freedom is never more than one generation from extinction. And I'm looking at what's happening, and I'm looking at these fools who don't seem to grasp the gravity of the situation or the nature of the adversaries that we face. And the first tell that you need to look for is someone who's a hypocrite. You have the Democrats running around saying the election deniers are a threat to democracy. No, well, wait a moment. I think they're right. Didn't Hillary Clinton claim she won even though she didn't? Didn't Stacey Abrams to this day say she won the election even
still
though she
hasn't.
Didn't? That's what
still
I'm saying.
Still hasn't conceded,
so
right.
So wait a moment. I do believe that they are a threat to democracy. What do you think of that statement?
Exactly. They really are. And, you know, we can go back to Al Gore. You know, maybe one of the original 21st century election deniers.
Yep, Mr. Hanging Chad himself.
Oh, God.
So my point is, as an agent, when we interrogated people, you were looking for hypocrisy. You were looking to figure out, is this person telling you the truth or not? Because that is so important. So there's two things I want to do, because the time always runs out too quickly. Number one, I just want to further the point about the Canadian border. There were two press releases that issued by the Justice Department on. Let me get a hold of this. Oh, bear with me one moment. I had it here. Once in a while, my computer and I have a disagreement, and that happens. Okay. Yeah, here we are. Okay, so this is Friday, July 29th, 2022. Here's the headline. Quebec man pleads guilty to conspiracy to import and distribute fentanyl. And the press release goes on to talk about all these people along the northern border that were moving huge quantities of fentanyl into the United States across which border? The northern border. Yet I turn on Fox News and I listen to the politicians and I listen to the journalists, so-called, and what do they talk about? The southern border. Why are we ignoring the northern border? If you look at what the 9/11 Commission had to say, most of the terrorists didn't come across our borders, but they came through international airports. I'd love to know what the visa refusal rates are now under the Biden administration for aliens seeking visas to enter the United States. I hope that if the Republicans gain control of at least one house, that they will hold hearings into that. Okay? We're not looking at how many people are being rejected at the international port of entry and told, you don't qualify, the way I did when I was an inspector. Again, I relate to these issues because I did that job for 4 years. That's the advantage that I bring to the table that the talking heads on TV don't have. We've naturalized terrorists. We've naturalized terrorists. Think about that. And you have Mayorkas, the head of Homeland Security, saying we're not going to go after people who lie about anything of a material nature to become a U.S. citizen. And meanwhile, the terrorists all tried to become citizens because then they get two passports. And by having two passports, they alternate which passport they travel on. As they move around the world, they cover their tracks. And with a U.S. passport, anybody who has a U.S. passport has access to airplanes, train stations, corporate buildings, government buildings. It's a pass. It's a pass to America. It's the key to the front door. It's the gold key. And you have an administration saying, we're not going to go after the fraud. What was interesting was that Donald Trump created a fraud unit specifically to go after people who lied on applications for citizenship because they understood that getting U.S. citizenship posed a threat to national security and enhanced the ability of terrorists to carry out attacks in the United States. And again, to that point, there was another press release on that very same day. Here we go. Give me one moment. I had it. I don't know why I don't have it here, but I will have it in a moment. Well, but understand the point. It's this narrow-minded, we're just going to look at the Canadian border. Why? Because we're even hearing some of the Republicans running, like this woman down in Texas who was born in Mexico, her husband's a Border Patrol agent, saying, well, once you secure the border, then we can give legal status to all these people who are here now. No, we can't, and no, we shouldn't. No, we can't, and no, we shouldn't, okay? So why is she saying it? Do you realize that if we legalize what's probably a population of 30 or 40 million, each and every one of them will be granted status without an interview because it's not possible to interview them. Certainly no field investigations. There will be no way to know who they are or when they got here. The talking heads on TV, you know, they sit there and they're yakking away and no one questions them because everyone's on the same page. So one of the first things you hear is, well, if these people have been living here for the last 6 years and they've committed no crimes, we should absolutely give them status. Question number one, how do you know how long an illegal alien has been living in the United States if they ran the border? There's no record of entry. What would prevent an alien from entering the United States 3 weeks from tomorrow and filling out an application wherein he or she claimed to have been here for the last 15 years? How could you figure out that it's a lie? Now, realize the adjudicator, a job I did for a year, will probably have no more than a half hour to conduct an interview without a field investigation. So how do you look at the application and say, oh, and probably the person won't even be there. They're going to look at the application and they'll fill it. They'll make a decision just based on the information. So they check off all the boxes and then they put down an entry date of 2003. What are you supposed to do? I'll tell you what they're going to do. They're going to approve it. And the 9/11 Commission identified immigration fraud as the key method of entry and vetting for the terrorists. So now we have another press release issued by the Justice Department July 29th, same time as the fentanyl one. Here's the headline. Leading ISIS media figure and foreign fighter sentenced to life imprisonment, Mohammed Khalifa executed two Syrian soldiers on behalf of ISIS and served as the English-speaking narrator of an exceptionally violent ISIS propaganda video. And the press release starts out by saying the following. You're going to love this, folks. A Saudi-born Canadian citizen was sentenced today to life imprisonment for conspiring to provide material support to the Islamic State of Iraq and Al-Sham, or ISIS, a designated foreign terrorist organization resulting in death. This guy's up on the Canadian border. When was the last time you heard anybody on the news talk about the crisis on the Canadian border? The 12th of never,
not
perhaps?
Not ever. Yeah.
Okay.
Not ever.
Okay.
It's always the southern border.
Now,
always.
Right. So why is that? Now, let's look at another story that was not properly reported on, and it's the basis for my latest article for Front Page Magazine. I hope everybody will go to Front Page Mag after the program. Here's the headline. Former Defense Department contract translator arrested for alleged ties to ISIS, the ongoing threat of jihad. So now, first thing I'm going to tell you that's going to blow you away, the Justice Department has never issued a press release about this arrest. You would think they'd be crowing. Now, maybe if they found out that he belonged to the Parents Association, they would issue a press release. I don't know. I'm just, you know, there's a little supposition there. The Department of Defense would issue a statement. In fact, Rolling Stone wrote about it, and in their article, the reporter said that they reached out to the Justice Department for comment. And at the time of publication, the Justice Department had yet to respond. Let me read a little bit of my own article. I guess I'm plagiarizing myself, so that's okay. A former Department of Defense contract interpreter, Mohammed Rafi Mohammadi, has been arrested for allegedly having lied about his connection to ISIS and his application for a security clearance in conjunction with his employment by the Department of Defense. The arrest of this defendant is of great significance. However, while information about the case was published in several news reports, it has incredibly not been reported by the Justice Department. And it goes on, and I talk about this particular case. Now, the next thing you need to know is this guy, as a translator, and they didn't make that point in any of the articles I read about it, which blows me away. They missed the most salient issue. Translators scare me. Now, this is out of my own 30 years of experience of working with translators and interpreters. Why do they worry me? Well, because I've used translators and interpreters during the course of my 30-year career. They act as my eyes, ears, and mouth, and the eyes, ears, and mouth of the person that I'm interrogating. I have no clue if the person that I'm talking to is really saying what the translator claims they claim. I have to trust the translator to be honest. And I remember a case at the airport, because the airport, the airlines would provide us with translators. So I remember a young lady came in on Alitalia, very pretty young lady. She was in her early 20s. But I did have some Spanish training in Border Patrol Academy. So since they're both Romance languages, while I can't speak Italian, I knew enough to understand sort of what was happening. So the translator comes in, and I'm asking, well, how long do you plan to stay, and who are you going to be staying with? And the translator lied. I mean, flat out lied. And he said, oh, she's staying with her brother. And she said she didn't know anyone here based on my knowledge of Spanish, which was close enough to Italian. And I asked a couple more questions. And then I brought another translator over, and it was clear this guy was lying. I had my boss call the station chief who was having dinner to the inspections area. The guy was fired. Apparently, the girl told him, if you can get me through the process, we'll have a nice time. Wink, wink. Okay? No lives were at stake. She was coming here to work, God knows doing what. But the point was, the translator was the guy you rely on. Now, if I didn't understand Spanish at all, they might have gotten away with it. Well, so here's the girl who was going to work in the United States. No lives lost. Imagine now you're dealing with someone from a country that sponsors terrorism. And the person is lying to you about the answers that they're giving you and now is in the position to identify an informant and the agents who are working the case. And through the questions, the interpreter now knows what we're concerned about and what we're looking for. This has the potential to get agents and informants killed. It also has the potential to enable terrorists to game the process to gain entry into the United States. And where was this translator working, folks? Fasten your seatbelt. Afghanistan. And it turns out that he had contact, as the FBI came to find out, with ISIS-K, and they were responsible for the murder of 13 soldiers when we turned tail and fled from Afghanistan, thanks to the non-leadership of Joe Biden. And how many other soldiers came home grievously injured? So this guy is in communication with that terror group working on behalf of ISIS. And what does he get charged with? Not providing material support to a terrorist group, which he should have been in my judgment, but lying on his application to get a security clearance so he could get the job as a translator. Not a bedtime story. Not a bedtime story. Now, the other question, not asked by any of the journalists, but I ask it, is, well, there's a good possibility this guy came to America as an alien. I doubt that he was born in the United States. If he was, well, then that line of questioning goes away. But no one addressed that, what should be obvious question. So the question is, how did he get to the United States? Is anybody going through his immigration applications to see if he lied so we can strip him of any lawful status he may have? Now, why is that important? Well, think about it. Let's say he's now a United States citizen, but he concealed material facts about his involvement with terrorism. Now, remember what Mayorkas said, we're not going to pursue those cases anymore. Well, do you want this terrorist to go to jail for, let's say, 5 years, because that's the penalty for lying on his application for a clearance, and 5 years from now when he gets out of jail, if he's convicted, if he did what appears that he did, he's free to wander around the United States freely. Does that give you the warm fuzzies that an affiliate of ISIS-K responsible for the bombing of the airport in Afghanistan could be floating around the United States freely and at will with no limitations? Or would you feel a little bit better and maybe get a better night's sleep if we could strip him of his immigration status and deport him so that he doesn't have the opportunity to attack us? And by the way, there was nothing in the article about anybody saying, gee whiz, maybe, just maybe, we should grab every application where this guy was the translator and make certain that we don't have terrorists who used his ability to conceal their involvement with terrorism to get them into the United States, because my sense is that he was involved with the questioning of so-called Afghan refugees. And now let's add to that the fact that the FBI has now been given millions of dollars for what reason? To hunt down the Afghan refugees who were not properly vetted when they were admitted after the screw-up in Afghanistan. Folks, I'm going to tell you, this takes my breath away. This absolutely is stupefying to me. I haven't seen it on any of the news networks. This should be a headline story. But all we're hearing about is the Mexican border. This guy probably had nothing to do with the Mexican border, but that's all we need. And today, Fox News reported that 85% of Americans want more Border Patrol agents. Really? How about ICE agents? The way that ICE was created, the way that Homeland Security was created by George W. Bush, violated the Homeland Security Act. Does anybody realize that? And in point of fact, let's see if I could find this. Well, I'll paraphrase it, but the entire point, though, that John Hostetler, who was the Republican chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, made, I just want to see if I can find this. Well, what Hostetler warned about was that the 9/11, everybody knew that 9/11 and other terror attacks were only possible because of multiple failures of the immigration system, not the customs system, not agriculture. It was immigration. In fact, the first time I appeared before a congressional hearing was 4.5 years before 9/11, and the topic of the hearing was immigration fraud and visa fraud because of the 1993 terror attacks carried out in the United States at the CIA and the first Trade Center bombing, all involved aliens from the Middle East who one way or the other gamed the immigration system and lied. And so Hostetler made the point that they were trying in creating Homeland Security to eliminate the loopholes and the flaws in the system so we wouldn't get hit again. That's why I did all those hearings before Congress and had closed-door sessions with other members of Congress. Immigration was never supposed to be cut in half between Customs and Border Protection and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and they were never supposed to fold other agencies in. Immigration was supposed to be a standalone agency the way it used to be. The only thing that we were really focused on, that I was working unofficially with Congress on this, was to spin off the benefit side, the people, the adjudicators that decided about citizenship and political asylum and so forth. They shouldn't have been part of the enforcement program. But in fact, what I spoke about when I testified 6 weeks after 9/11 before the Immigration Reform Caucus was something that I call the Immigration Enforcement Tripod. And the idea is that the inspectors enforce the laws at ports of entry, the Border Patrol between ports of entry, and we've always neglected interior enforcement. And I said that needs to get as much attention and resources as the border. In the country, If you do nothing about people who shouldn't be here and who pose a threat, then you can't protect the United States. And Hostetler actually said that the way they put DHS together, the Department of Homeland Security, violated the Homeland Security Act, created immigration incoherence, making it impossible to secure the borders, enforce the laws, or protect the American people. And that was George W. Bush. Now, the reason I'm telling you this, I hope that whoever you voted for wins. I hope whoever you voted for understands the need to protect America and sees in all of our borders and methods of entry our first and last line of defense. But hoping isn't the strategy. We need to make certain that we are in communication with these elected leaders of ours and hold them accountable. You know, when you bring a puppy home, the first order of business is to housebreak the dog. Since these people work in the house, maybe we need to housebreak these congressmen. What do you think of that, James?
Yeah, something's got to happen. I mean, you and I have talked about this many times.
You did like my sick humor. You did like my sick humor.
Absolutely. Yeah, because they're dragging their minds all over the carpet down there, and who knows what else. Yeah, it's terrible. And you and I have talked about this before. This transcends what we're talking about. Transcends party politics. It goes way beyond that. What we're talking about is right and wrong and what is good and what is harmful to this country based on what these greedy, ambitious SOBs in D.C. are doing. And it's either side.
Oh, I absolutely. Now, realize when Eisenhower left the White House, he thanked both parties for being nonpartisan and supporting all of his programs to fix America after World War II. We had the crap scared out of us, and rightfully so, and we were focused. And similarly, after 9/11, I was in Washington. I mean, realize that. So I saw what happened after 9/11, and these characters were shaking in their boots. Sheila Jackson Lee took George W. Bush to task for not spending the money Congress gave him to hire ICE agents, Border Patrol agents, or purchase detention space. I kid you not. And I remember getting a phone call from the chief counsel for the House Judiciary Committee on the Republican side. And it was kind of an unusual place to be because Bush would say or do something really stupid. Well, he did that almost any day with a Y in it. So, I mean, it wasn't a novelty. That's why when I met you, I told you, what did I call George W. Bush? America's answer
well,
to whom?
We were down there at the Red. Yeah, and if somebody came up with Bush and I was looking over at Uni with what? Me worry? And I cracked up because that was exactly how I always saw him.
Yep. Yeah, he almost looked like
that
him,
was
too.
His look. Yep. And when he said that, I thought, that was a good one.
Well, I call him as I see him, as you pointed out in the beginning of the show. I'm not being partisan. I'm being American. And we should all be American. We should all be. I'm so tired of people. Well, once we get rid of those damn Democrats. No. Listen, my father warned me. He said, Mike, nothing is so good it couldn't be made better or be so bad that it couldn't get worse. Trust me.
Right.
Okay? You thought Obama was bad? Well, now you've got Biden. God help us. Please understand the problem. And this is all a distraction. You know, I started mentioning the magician. The magician promises to cut his assistant in half. We all know he's not going to do it because if he does, he's going to go to jail. No one's ever going to work with him again. And maybe hope to have spend the evening with her. God knows. So they create a very elaborate illusion. And everyone is entertained. Well, most Americans would say, yeah, enforce the immigration laws, protect lives, protect national security, protect Americans' jobs. And by the way, foreign workers tend to send tens of billions of dollars of money out of the economy as an added insult to injury, okay? So why would we not want to take care of our immigration laws and not just the Mexican border? Why do we keep hearing about Border Patrol but not about interior enforcement? Because this is an immigration delivery system. And what it delivers is an unlimited supply of cheap, exploitable labor. It's not just the illegals. It's the high-tech visas. Think about what Alan Greenspan had to say. I was so pissed about Alan Greenspan. I was on a radio show the next day, by the way, after that hearing in 2009. And the program I was on was in Madison, Wisconsin, and Vicky was the host. And Vicki said to me, she said, Mike, you got to watch that hearing yesterday. What were your thoughts about Greenspan? I said, well, as I sat in my house watching him on my computer, I knew I was witnessing a first. And she said, oh, my gosh. She said, I know I'm on thin ice when I ask you what kind of a first was it, but I have to ask, what kind of a first was it? I said, it was the first time I'd ever seen someone testify who was suffering from rigor mortis. She told me she spent the rest of her program mopping up her mascara from laughing so hard.
That's pretty good, too.
But, I mean, the nerve to call high-tech middle-class Americans the privileged elite while you fly around the world
in your
private jets and well, it's tragic. And he was the – I mean, what are we doing? You know, we allow this to happen. My father told me that I would instruct people how they should treat me by demonstrating what I'm willing to accept. And he said, if you allow someone to step all over you, he said, don't blame me. Don't even blame them. You allowed it. You allowed it. And I remember one time my parents served up a very important lesson. It was on the weekend. This was shortly before we knew that they were sick. And on the weekend, we all had driver's licenses. We were all starting to drive, and everyone's so excited that we're going to drive our parents' car. And there was a nightclub out on Long Island in Roosevelt Field where Lindbergh actually took off to fly to Paris. And in those days, the shopping mall was first starting, so there were actually airplane hangars there that were being used for disco and so forth to drive. And my parents had the sense that my buddies were taking advantage of me. They really weren't my buddies, and we've all been down the road. You know, my parents told me, if right. you're blessed to have as many real friends as you have fingers on one hand, you've done well. So I laugh when people tell me, I've got 3,000 friends on Facebook. I said, yeah, call them up at 3 o'clock in the morning when you got a problem. See who shows up. Am I wrong? So
yeah, exactly.
My parents realized
exactly.
I was being played for, and they realized I was being played for a fool. And so my father decided to teach me a lesson. And he said to me, Mike, I'm sorry. I'm going to need the car on Friday night. You can have it tomorrow night, but Friday night, why don't you call up your friend Dave and see if he can, you know, maybe accommodate you. Maybe he's going to borrow his father's car. I said, gee, it's too bad, Dad. I was looking forward to getting out there. You know, the music is great. It's fun meeting the girls. He said, well, I'm sorry. You're going to have to make other means of getting out there. Well, there's no buses or trains to get out to Long Island. So I called up my friend Dave, and I said, Dave, is there any way? He says, oh, no, I'm not going to be able to get my father's car. We're stuck. No big deal. I said, okay, so be it. Now, 2 hours later, right after we would have left to go to Roosevelt Field, my pop comes up to me. He goes, you know what, Mike? I've been thinking about it. Why don't you go take the car? I said, well, what are you and Mom going to do? He said, oh, we'll be okay. We'll make our own way. Take the car. So I took the car, and I get to the nightclub, and guess who's there? My friend Dave with three
all
or four
your,
of our
except
friends.
Except you.
Except me. And I came home that night, and my father said to me, so who did you run into tonight? My parents were brilliant, I got to tell you. He said, you see your friends? I said, yeah, Dad, I did. He said, and what BS story did they give you? I said, Dad, I don't even want to waste your time with it. He said, did you learn a lesson? I said, yes, I did. You see? And he said to me, this is your fault. He said, because you need to take better care of looking out for yourself. How's that for a lesson? And we are responsible for the mess we're in. You know, when I started doing what I did, people said to me, you're nuts. You're not going to, well, that may be true, too. That's a discussion for another day. But I was so furious at what was going on in immigration. I said, you know what? I'm going to go to Congress, and I'm going to get on TV, and I'm going to and my friends looked at me, and one of my buddies came up. He said, Mike, listen, if you keep saying stuff like that, they're going to take your security clearance. You're crazy. You're a field agent. Field agents don't testify before Congress. You're a field agent, and field agents don't go on national television. I said, no. I said, you don't understand. I'm going to do this. And he looked at me, and he said, you're out of your mind. You got to stop talking that way. Well, of course, we know what happened. And then people said, well, aren't you worried that they're going to get you? I said, who's they? I said, aren't you worried when you go into a building to take down a guy with a gun? Sometimes you got to man up. Sometimes you have to grow hair on your chest or spine. Sometimes you got to take a risk. Life isn't a safe proposition. And it's amazing because this all started, I'm going to try to give you the condensed version of it. The way that I wound up going to Congress involves wiper blades on my government car. I kid you not. We couldn't get money to fill up the gas tank on government cars at immigration. That's how bad it was. I used to borrow credit cards from the FBI, DEA, and ATF to gas up my government car. And one day, I was out there in the middle of a nor'easter, you know, one of those massive storms that comes up the East Coast and blasts you with wind and rain. And I couldn't see where I was going. I was working at 4 to midnight. And I went out and bought wiper blades. And the next morning, we put in all of our paperwork. It was the end of the month. And at the end of every month, you had to submit all your expenses and all your investigative reports. It was almost like filing a tax return every 30 days. And my boss called me in. He says, what do you mean you bought wiper blades? How much was that? And I said, $26. And he went crazy. And my boss was an idiot to begin with. So we wound up yelling at each other in the squad area to the point that I went home with laryngitis that night. And he was so dopey, I said to him, listen, wiper blades are cheaper than a new bumper and front grill. And everyone else understood what I was saying. I didn't want to crash the car. But he's looking at me saying, why would you need a new grill? I mean, that's the level of brilliance. But I was so angered by this that I had to get laryngitis because I used a little common sense because the wiper blades I had were flogging themselves to death on my windshield. And I couldn't see anything. I was scared to death I was going to crash. And the next day, as luck would have it, a buddy of mine in California sends me a snail mail newspaper clipping. That's all we had back then. This was the early 1990s. And it was a clipping about how the commissioner of the Immigration Service and three or four of her cohorts had given each other $30,000 bonuses for their brilliance and leadership. And I thought, my God, I have laryngitis over $26 wiper blades, and they each gave each other $39,000 and $36,000 and $38,000 bonuses. And that was when I called the House Immigration Subcommittee out of anger, and by dumb luck, who gets on the phone but the chief counsel? And everything flowed from that phone call. How's that for an amazing story? If you ever saw the movie The Adjustment Bureau, that's what it felt like. She was the one who arranged me to do my first hearing, the chief counsel. And, everything flowed from that moment. We come to that fork in the road. Was it Yogi Berra said, when you get to the fork in the road, take it? Okay, so we did.
Take it.
but at some point, people have to stand up and say, this is just wrong. And you have some brave FBI agents are stepping forward now to talk about the abuses at the Bureau. We have to grow a spine as Americans, folks, because the consequences are way too severe if we don't. This is about not me. It's about America. It's about my children. It's about my grandchildren. And God willing, about their children one day. And the same for every one of you out there. At some point, you know something is wrong. Please stand up. Don't wait for someone else. We had a woman killed in Queens, New York, God, decades ago, Kitty Genovese. She was raped and killed, and the screams went on for like 2 hours. Whatever. It was awful. And nobody called the police. And when the police canvassed the building, it was an apartment house, everyone said, yeah, I heard her shrieking, but I thought somebody else was going to make the call. They could have saved her life. We are obligated to each other as Americans because your candidate won the election. The work first now begins. This isn't now it's time for a victory lap and we can go back to sleep. We've got a housebreak those Congress people who got elected. Literally, we have to housebreak them. Otherwise, they're going to piss all over us. Am I wrong?
And you're exactly right because this is where the war begins. Okay, these people said the things that the voter base wanted to hear. They gave the show and they sold voters on what they're going to do to their constituency. And now comes the time after they take their hand off the Bible is you got to start watching. And if they don't do what they said, you've got to kick their ass and make sure that they do. If everybody gets all excited about term limits and this and that. And I can see the certain extent, I can see the merit in it. But you voted the guy in, you can vote his ass out.
Yep. And by the way, people making a lot of the decisions aren't the people you voted for. It's their staffers. And their staffers are being sought by K Street, by the lobbyists. And they're telling them, if you could get that congressman's vote on this bill, that bill, and the other bill, we'll get you a job in 8 months, and you're going to make double or triple what they're paying you right now. So when you call up Congressman Schmidlap or whoever, and you say, I'd like to speak to Jane Smith. I spoke to her 3 weeks ago. Oh, no, she left. She's over at, you know, whatever. Well, who's there now? They give you another name, and that person's gone 8 months from now, too. Not all. Some stay, but a lot of them leave. They don't make much money. These are people very often who have law degrees from the best law schools. They know they're highly marketable and highly sought after. So this is just like the Boy Scout troop that wanted to get on every train stop in the New York City subway system. They're just getting their ticket punched. Yep, I did 8 months as a congressional aide. Right? There's a law firm now that's dealing with what happened at the tainted water, okay? And our lawyers served in Washington. Right. So what does that mean? Well, their lawyers worked for a congressman or a senator or at the White House. They were there for 8 months, and then they split. And while they were there, what damage did they do to prove to their would-be new employer that they are loyal and capable? You see? And very often, the member of Congress is clueless. I remember meeting Jim Sensenbrenner when George W. Bush was pushing his guest worker amnesty program. Another funny story. And my degree was in communications arts and sciences, even though I was originally going to be an engineering major. When I lost my parents, frankly, my ability to study evaporated overnight. I was dealing with with my two sick parents. I was an only child, so I was working, going to college, and caring for both of them. I was averaging 3 hours of sleep a night. And to be honest with you, it's how many decades later, I still have nightmares about it. As I said, we're all damaged by life, and we need to be compassionate with one another. But you know, understand that when you understand where we all are with all of these issues, we should be standing shoulder to shoulder to push the issues. And so I took my degree in communications arts and sciences, and I learned how you have to operate in order to be an effective communicator. And I find that to be an invaluable background dealing with the issues that we're dealing with today. And you can win people over by the use of language. Words are so critical. Orwell was terrific. If you want a great book to read, it's a quick read. It's not that long. Read 1984. You'll understand about the impact of words. They're critical. So Bush called it the guest worker program. And I decided to tack one additional word on. And the word was amnesty. And those were the days when I was on with Lou Dobbs Tonight, you know, at least twice a week at CNN. And he used to plagiarize my articles. I wrote this piece. And I remember taking my kids to the dentist, and Lou Dobbs came on, and we have a satellite radio in our van. And, you know, he came on, and he quoted me basically verbatim. You know, in Washington, President George W. Bush continues to push his guest worker amnesty program. And that word amnesty made all the difference in the world. And a couple of months later, I was in Washington for a panel discussion about terrorism. And Jim Sensenbrenner, who at the time was chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and he was the one who had invited me to do a number of hearings, came into the room, came up to me. I was surprised that he remembered me, shook my hand. And, you know, when you have an opportunity, seize the opportunity. It doesn't come back again. My mother taught me that. I remember meeting Jim Lovell briefly at the souvenir shop at the Houston Space Center when I was on a four-day weekend when I was at the Border Patrol Academy. I went to Houston. And he pointed to a map of the moon that was for sale and said, I remember as we were orbiting the moon, we came over this crater, and every time we came, the lighting changed, and it was like a kaleidoscope. And I didn't want to impose on him and say, gee whiz, if I bought that, would you autograph it? I should have. And I walk out of the souvenir shop, and I'm thinking, that was stupid. Let me go run back in, and I'll buy the map. Well, I ran back in. The map was there, but Jim Lovell was gone. And so my opportunity to get him to autograph that map went away. So when Sensenbrenner approached me, I said, well, I'm not going to blow it this time. And he had just endorsed the guest worker program. And so he comes up to me. And humor, by the way, is a very effective weapon. It really is better than bombast and all this other business. I only wish Trump understood that. And so when he came up to me, I said to him, Mr. Chairman, it's great to meet you. You made a speech last week, and I haven't had a good night's sleep since. All I would like is you know, I'd like to have a meeting with you. Is there any way I could meet with you for, you know, whatever? Well, I'd have to talk to my scheduler and this one and that one. I said, look, can you give me 30 seconds? He said, I'll give you a minute. Is this about national security? And I knew that humor would get him to listen, because when politicians are out and about with the public, their goal is to shake everyone's hand, make everybody smile, hopefully pick up votes and pick up campaign contributions. It's a crazy business for these politicians. LBJ, Johnson, used to call it pressing the flesh. So I decided to have a little fun, and I'm thinking if I could slow him down with humor, I'll get him to listen to me. So he said, well, is this discussion because of my speech about national security that you can't sleep at night? Well, I said, of course it's about national security. I sure as hell wouldn't be discussing my sex life with you, would I? And Sensenbrenner just broke up laughing. How's that for quick thinking?
So now I guess you've got to
and everybody
or he's disappointed.
And everybody
I don't know
in the room heard me, and everybody broke up laughing. So now I did what I wanted to do, and that was to slow him down to get him to actually listen. Because I'm convinced if I had said to him, dog poop stinks, he would have said, you're right, thanks for telling me, and he would have kept on going. And he said, so what's the problem? I said, you're favoring a program that would give millions of people identity documents, and there'd be no interviews. This goes against the 9/11 Commission. This could cause another terror attack. He said, very interesting. Started to walk away, and it was like it took about, I don't know, 5 seconds, and the thoughts went from his ears to the brain, and he just stopped dead in his tracks, and his entourage of staffers who were walking with him sent him. It looked like a freeway pileup. It was actually pretty funny. And he comes back. He's, Mr. Cutler, you take all the damn time you need. You've got my undivided attention. And I explained it to him. I said, if you give people lawful status and they snuck into the country, we will never know who they are, when they got here, or why they're here. But we will be giving them official identity documents that will enable them to get driver's licenses, social security cards, credit cards. They'll have access to corporate office buildings. Hell, they could walk into your office. I said, we're setting ourselves up for the next terror attack to provide a program that we don't need. And he just looked at me, and I said, you know, I'm a New Yorker. My neighbors died on 9/11. You know my background. My only question for you, Mr. Chairman, is why the hell would you do this to us? And his color changed completely. He said, I'm so...
Oh, no.
People who were tuning in. And there's Jim Sensenbrenner doing a news conference, and I'm watching, and I'm watching, and I'm watching, and finally some reporter asked him, how soon will we get this guest worker program up and running? And Sensenbrenner's demeanor changed completely, and he said, let me tell you something. You're going to get that program, but only over my dead body, because it has the capability of getting a lot of Americans killed, and I have withdrawn my supports for it. That afternoon, I got a call from one of his people. And the guy said to me, what the hell did you tell the boss? He came in here today threatening to fire everybody. He said, I've been listening to you guys, and that guy Cutler was right. And it blew me away. But what the members of Congress frequently do is rely on their staffers for advice on how to vote on issues, among other people. It's a challenge to get through the clutter, to get past those gatekeepers to the people who make the decisions. But we can do it. And we do it with facts. And if you go to my website, michaelcutler.net, if you go to my radio show, which is the Michael Cutler Hour on Blog Talk Friday nights at 7 East Coast time, for my articles, you have all the facts. I believe that you need forward those articles to everyone you can, especially the people who disagree with you. This is America. We should be celebrating the fact that we disagree. That's, again, what the First Amendment is about. Your neighbor who disagrees with you probably disagrees with you because he or she really doesn't understand the issue. But be gentle with them because they are invested in their perspective. It's like trying to get someone to convert from one religion to the other. So it's not about calling them names or insulting them or telling them they're idiots. Find common ground. You and I are both concerned about our children's future. Well, here's something for you to think about. All the money being spent on foreign students means that we're not able to spend the same kind of money or enough money on American kids. Whatever. Pick the topic. We have a drought in the West, and it's not getting any better. Every person who's in the United States needs 100 gallons of water per day. True story. I did a little bit of digging. So Biden brought in how many millions of people? Each person in the country needs 100 gallons of water per day. We're talking about hundreds of millions of gallons of water a day being used by people who wouldn't be here but for Joe Biden. I want someone to tell me how that is not a convincing argument. There are ways of making the case, and they're irrefutable, and they're not mean-spirited. And the final thing, people say, well, you know, on the left, they're all about feelings. Well, so am I, and so are you. Please don't use the term bleeding heart liberal. Who do you want for a friend, a cold-hearted SOB or somebody who's compassionate? My question is, why doesn't compassion apply to Americans? If we're compassionate and you want to do right by people who get jammed up, why don't we try to prevent them from getting jammed up in the first place? If you look at people who wind up in jail for petty street crime, most are functionally illiterate. We keep hearing about mass shootings. I'd love to know what the toxicology reports look like on the people who pull the trigger. With all the drugs flowing into this country, how many people have killed people under the influence of drugs when they pulled the trigger? When people have a massive car accident, the first question is, was he drunk? Was he on drugs? Why in the world aren't we asking the same question about mass shootings? How's that for an interesting question? These are the questions we can and must ask everybody, from the politician to your next-door neighbor. Just my thoughts. What do you think, James?
I think it's been, as usual, an outstanding 2 hours of radio with you, my friend. We've been talking with Michael Cutler, and if you guys have been listening to the program anytime at all, you know what a thrill ride that is. Mike, we're down. We got about 2.5 minutes left. Make sure these folks know, again, where they can find you and when.
Lost and found. You can find me on Lost and Found.
Somebody please come get this.
You know, it's like the drunk that calls the operator, and the operator says, can I help you? He says, yeah, could you trace the call? I'm drunk, and I want to find out where I am.
Tell me where I'm at.
No, I write for Front Page Magazine. Very proud of my affiliation with the David Horowitz Freedom Center since 2014. It's frontpagemag.com.
Yeah.
My own website is michaelcutler.net, C-U-T-L-E-R, and I do my own blog talk radio program Friday night. Appropriately enough, we call it the Michael Cutler Hour, 7 p.m. on Blog Talk. So please get involved. You know, I keep making the point, democracy is not a spectator sport, and this election, while pivotal and critical, because we are at crossroads, should only be the beginning of our relationship with our elected leaders. We gave them the job. Now they need supervision. I had an evaluation routinely on my job, and I'm sure you are evaluated on your jobs, folks. And this needs to be a two-way street, and relationships must be two-way. Establish that relationship with your elected representatives on all levels, and please make the point that there's nothing anti-immigrant about enforcing laws that were intended to protect public safety, public health, national security, and the jobs and wages of Americans. There is no sensible way to argue against it. The one question every politician must be asked, how are your proposals, how are your policies in the best interests of the average American? That question covers a lot of territory, and it's the one that all of us must ask every elected representative. James, I want to thank you for having me on the show today. It's always a privilege, and again, my condolences.
Michael, you are my good friend. We're always happy to have you here. You have a home with us anytime you want to be here. You know that. Ladies and gentlemen, our friend Michael Cutler once again talking about whatever the hell he wants, and I wouldn't put it any other way on this program. So, listen, it's a treat when you're on. It really is, and my listeners love it. That's all the time we've got, folks. Mike, once again, thank you for your generosity. Thank you for your friendship.
Absolutely.
I'll be looking forward to talking to you soon. You guys take care.
Absolutely.
That's all
be
from
well.
A conservative's perspective. You guys take care.